Hello again, and welcome to another edition of Authors Audio. I'm your host, Jake D. Steele. You can always find us on the web at worldwideweb.authorsaudio.com and click on the listen icon to listen to all of our podcasts. I'm very happy today to have an American author with us, Duff Brenna, and he is the author of 6 published novels, The Book of Mamie, The Holy Book of the Beard, Too Cool, The Altar of the Body, The Willow Man, and most recently, The Law of Falling Bodies. Duff Brenna is a professor emeritus of English literature and creative writing at the California State University in San Marcos. His books have been translated into Danish, Dutch, Finnish, German, Hebrew, and Japanese. And I'm very proud to have with us today Duff Brenna. Duff, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine, and thank you for having me.
Well, we're very happy to have you on the program, Duff, and I know that your books have been translated into 6 different languages, your 6 novels, and so I would say that makes you an international author for sure.
International, yes.
Well, first off, Duff, I'd like to congratulate you on winning the prestigious AWP Award, the Association of Writers and Writing Programs Award, for your book, Mamie. Now, did that happen this year or was that last year?
No, that happened in 1988. And that novel went through 2 runs with Doubleday and, University of Iowa. And then it was allowed to go out of print, and a publisher in Oregon, in the Grand Oregon, read it. And this was just in 2004, and it had been out of print all that time. And he got in touch with me, and he said, "I really love this novel, and I'd like to reprint it and in paperback." And, of course, I was thrilled. I thought probably Mamie would never be see the light of day again unless a movie was made of it. And so I said, sure, go ahead. And so he reprinted it. It came out 2 years ago. And it's sold fairly well since then. And, of course, we're using the point that it did win a major national award to try to get folks to take a look at it again. It's also been optioned for a movie by a Canadian producer. You may know him. His name is Jim Kaufman. He lives in Montreal. And,
excellent.
And I wrote a screenplay for it, and he's absolutely thrilled about the screenplay. So he's trying to get Mamie on the screen, so maybe that'll happen too. So who knows?
Well, that's certainly one thing that I wanted to bring up in your novel, is that the atmospheric setting that it's in is supported so well by the vernacular of rural Wisconsin and the conversations and idioms that the characters have between each other. And I think you're going to find that once you get into this book, it's going to be very hard to put down, because the characters just move the book along on its own.
Right. Well, I was born and raised in Minnesota, and spent much of my life in Minnesota on a farm. And then I left that. I went into the service. I did other things, worked construction. But I managed to get enough money together to move to northern Wisconsin, where the farms were cheaper. And I bought myself a cheap farm up right near Lake Superior. And I ran that farm for 3 years, but then I went bankrupt. It was a bad time to do this. This was in the mid-80s, and everything got auctioned off. I lost the farm, but I had that story. I had the authenticity of that story that I had been working on, trying to get it written about Mamie. And Mamie Beaver is based on a real character. This is somebody that lived in Forston, Minnesota, where my mother and my aunt used to live. And I was just listening to them one day talk about Mamie. And they were talking about how the town didn't know quite what to do with her. She was an orphan. She was not that bright, but she was mechanical. And this was during the time when they were just bringing out the movie houses that you could go see a movie. And they found out that Mamie had an affinity for the projector in that town. And the town folks, whoever it was, the projectionist, taught her how to disassemble and reassemble that machine and run these movies, and they made her the town projectionist. And she got so caught up in this, as my aunt and my mother tell it, that she fell in love with a projector. And the projector was a Chicago Powers, Chicago, Illinois projector. And she would come out of the booth, and there would be graphite on her face and on her hands. And my mother said one day, "Mamie, what are you doing?" And Mamie said, "Oh, it's that Powers. He loves me so." And what it turns out to be is that she's kissing and loving up this projector. And that just caught my imagination to think about that girl doing that. And of course, if you're a writer, the immediate thing is, why? Well, what's the connection here? What is it that is making her behave this way? What's the story behind that? And I sat down, I wrote a short story thinking, I'll just write a short story, see if I can kind of go to the answer. But that wasn't enough. And I kept writing and I kept writing and I kept writing. And ultimately, it's the book, that you've got in front of you there, which starts out and tries to bring the reader, because I wanted to bring myself there, to an explanation for why this slow learning, semi-retarded girl would fall so in love with this projector. And I found the answer, actually, in the course of writing the book. I mean, the answer that I have, in my head or imagine might be the real reason why Mamie fell in love with a projector. But, of course, nobody can get inside of Mamie's head and find out for sure, why she did that. So that was that's what took over. That became the purpose for writing that book, was to find that answer.
Yes. I think the book, it has a little, it's very Americana in its nature, but there's a little bit of the, for me, a little bit of the Mark Twain kind of feel to it, because of the rural setting, I suppose, and also the dialect, and you really get the feeling that you're right there, and right there with them.
You put your finger right on it, Jake, because the inspiration for writing Mamie in the style that I wrote it comes right out of Huckleberry Finn. And
I was just going to say, amazing, yeah.
So it was, the idea of this journey, and you go on this journey, and you learn about life as you move through various adventures, and it's one adventure after another, just like Huckleberry Finn is, and you meet various people along the way, each set of characters having something to teach you as you go along the way, and so that's what I wanted to have happen, and I had to set it up. Well, how am I going to do this? Well, what do Jim and Huck do? They run away, so I set up a situation in which Mamie and Christian, the boy who tells the story, it's in Christian's voice, just as Huckleberry Finn is in Huck's voice. He set up a situation in which they have to run away from Mamie's fierce father, which is what Huck does. He runs away from Pap, if you recall, his very fierce father. he's able to get out of it. That is, Huck is able to get out of it when he finds Pap dead. My characters go all the way to the end with this father as a sort of juggernaut figure behind them, chasing them through one place to another throughout Wisconsin. So that's deliberate parallels that I had. And Huck Finn and, you know, Mark Twain's wonderful gift of being able to create this voice for me was something that I had to work on, because I, like your writers out there will recognize this, that you don't often just jump into a story and have it, the voice for that story, immediately in front of you. For instance, I tried writing Mamie first from third person limited, and I stayed with that for about 100 pages before I realized this is not working. It was too distant, I think. And I tried total omniscience. That did not work either. I couldn't do it from Mamie's point of view either. I did try that, but I knew I just could not say it from her point of view. Faulkner might be able to do that, you know, as he does in The Sound and the Fury, Benji's voice. You know, that would have to be something like that. So I couldn't pull that off. And then just one day, I remember when it happened. It happened in June 1984. I started writing the book in Christian's voice, and as soon as that happened, I knew I had a book with legs. I knew this was a book I was going to be able to write. It was one of those aha moments, you know, you might have had yourself when you write and you go, ah, this is it. I've got it. Finally, I've got it. And it was just a matter of following that voice after that. That voice that came, Mamie Beaver, she had to come from the moon or maybe even the stars, that just clicked. And I had that kid's voice, 15-year-old Christian Foggy, and I said, okay, you know, just listen, and this kid will tell you the story. And it worked fairly well after that. I didn't have a huge struggle with writing the book once I got that voice.
Well, the book feels that way too. You know, you really feel that it progresses in a very natural way, and the characters and their little exploits drive the novel, and it feels very, very natural. It's a wonderful read. And I also noticed that you're Professor Emeritus of English Literature and Creative Writing at California State University, San Marcos. Okay, and you are also the fiction editor for Perigee Magazine.
Yeah, it's a literary magazine. I write most of the reviews for it. We are a magazine oriented toward independent presses, so that independent presses send me their books and I pick out, you know, three or four, whatever, to review and put in Perigee, recommending, you know, these are worthwhile novels or collections of short stories or whatever to pick up and read, because I think, and my fellow editors at Perigee think, that this is going to be the wave of the future for literature, that is, the independent publisher. So we wanted to do something to support the independent publisher. You know, we give them free advertising in the magazine. You know, they send us the picture of the book or something, and we'll run the picture with a little caption for it. And it's just something, you know, that we can do to keep literature from dying out in this country, and support it, you know, as much as possible. Yes.
Well, it's. I think that is the wave of the future, definitely.
I do too.
The internet is worldwide, and anyone around the world can to get to any site. I mean, we've never had this kind of access before.
That's right.
And people that are using it properly are getting excellent results. So I think that's a wonderful
site for writers to get to and find out what's going on in your neck of the woods there.
Well, also, what we've been able to do at Perigee is we have really raised the bar here so that the authors that are sending stories in are really becoming top-notch authors, some of them semi-famous or even famous, like Thomas E. Kennedy, like Jack Marshall, Walter Cummins, pretty well-known writers, James Brown, well-known writer. And we've gotten to the point now where we're getting a lot of attention from places like Pushcart Prize people. They picked one of our issues from last year, I think it was the October issue, and out of that one issue, four of our eight stories that we published were nominated for Pushcart Prizes. So that's never happened before. So we're getting first-rate writers, and this is an online magazine. And people say, well, you know, online, well, okay, but I'd rather be in hardcover, you know. But I think you're right. I think that also all of these people who are moving towards the e-zine sort of idea are right as well. One of the things we talked about at Perigee is this is one thing that's really environmentally friendly. So we're going to kind of push that idea of Perigee is green. You know, we don't chew up a lot of trees to create these magazines or this online magazine. And I think that given the state of the environment, I believe people will move more and more towards the online magazine. And I'm proud to be going that way and to be doing that way. And I'm especially proud that major writers are beginning to recognize this, and they're starting to send me stuff to publish that I'm really, really happy to see and to publish. And it's not just major writers. I mean, we've got a lot of just really solid, good writers, MFA students who send me stuff, graduates of teachers that are teaching creative writing and literature in colleges, sending me stuff. So this is a quality magazine, and I can only imagine that it's going to get better and better.
Well, again, the great thing is anyone around the world can visit your site, Jeff, at perigee-art.com and check out what you're doing down there, and perhaps you'll find some writer in the middle of nowhere that sends you a manuscript that you like very much. So who knows? You've been writing for quite a long time. You've got six books published already. Maybe we could talk a little bit more about, you know, how you started writing yourself.
Well, I started, you know, when I was like 15 years old. And I wanted to start before that when I read The Call of the Wild by Jack London. It was just one of my favorite books. And, I wish I could write stories like that, you know, and I read just about everything that London ever wrote. And then I did. I tried at 15, 16, I tried writing stories. Of course, they looked like 15, 16-year-old writing stories, you know. And it took me many years to learn this craft. It took me 20 years, really, to get Mamie the way it is now. When I was 26, I published my first story, finally, and actually got paid for that story. And I thought, well, you know, this is not so hard, you know, now that I sent this out and I got this published. Well, not so fast, because it took another 6 years before I was able to publish another story. And so it's a craft that I had a little bit of luck at 26 years of age, but then after that it was just more of learning what it's all about, how to do it, getting more and more experiences in life to write about, and then crafting those stories and getting them out there. And then, as you know, most of this business is rejection. And most of us get rejected again and again and again, even after we've done a lot of publishing. You know, I'll still get rejections from people, from publishers on short stories and whatnot, even after all of the stories and articles and books that I've published. I still get these rejections, and you've just got to learn how to handle that rejection in order to go on. You've got to be resilient. And if you're not resilient, you're probably not going to make it as a writer.
Well, we all know that rejections are tough, but in the end, sometimes rejections can be very thought-provoking and very helpful, and in the end, actually help you as a writer, as a creative
right,
person.
Right, it is a question.
So some people like muffins, some people like donuts. That's the way it goes out there.
That's exactly the way it is. You know, you get your book in front of, if I can say, the book of Mamie went to 36 publishers and numerous agents and was turned down by all of them. All of them turned it down. One agent said to me, I'm probably going to regret this, but I'm so busy, I have to turn Mamie down. So I was really getting discouraged because I thought, this is a very good book and it should get published. And I was in the hallway at the college where I teach, and I saw an advertisement for the AWP competition. And I wrote down the information, and I said, you know, what do I have to lose? I have anything to lose. And so I haul Mamie out, and I make a nice fresh copy. This is the time when you had to type things, you know, didn't have them on a computer. And I sent it to them. And went about my business for the next year, not thinking too much about it, trying not to think too much about it. And then one day I come home from work, and there's a message on the machine, and it's from a man named Toby Olson and a woman named Andrea Barrett. And Andrea Barrett is a National Book Award Prize winner. Toby Olson has won the Penn Faulkner Award, et cetera, et cetera. And saying, you know, give me a call. So I give him a call, and he says to me, Duff, have you published that book of yours? And I said, no, it's just sitting in the drawer there yellowing away. And he said, well, don't you worry about it. He said, because we're going to get that published. He says, you're getting first prize for best novel for that book from the AWP. And I was like, you know, who are you? You know, how can this be happening to me after all these years? I mean, we're talking about 20 years of struggle and then probably 4 years of trying just to get that one book published and not being able to get it published. And then just one day, boom, everything turns around for me. And Mamie gets published. Gets the AWP Award. The next year, she wins me a National Endowment for the Arts Award. I mean, it was a miracle year for me. Agents wanted me all of a sudden. I couldn't get an agent before, you know. And I sort of, like, had my pick, you know. Who do I want? You know, these wonderful agents want me, you know. And that book got published by Iowa. The next book got published by Doubleday. Doubleday published the third book. Picador published the fourth book. So it just got me going by winning that one award. And I could not get any attention before that came along. And I know, a lot of luck. And that's what you got to have as a writer, too. You not only need to be a good writer, a good, solid writer, but you have to have, just like you were saying, to get your work in front of the right pair of eyes, you know, the person that likes, you know, you like tea and they like tea, you know, kind of thing. And yeah, exactly.
Yes. Well, I've noticed I have a lot of artist friends, some writer friends, musicians and so on, and anybody involved with creating something new, literally out of the blue, and putting it together, having good form, having proper knowledge of the medium you're in, and working at it for many, many years, once you've finished your work, I say this to myself too, but I think it's true for all of us, is that you have to let the universe and fate of whatever is going to happen, then let it do its work. And it has its own,
it has its own
time frame. And once you've done your good work, you have to, and this is very hard to do. It's because you want to get it out the door tomorrow.
Yeah.
Or yesterday, even.
And you don't want to be dead when you're discovered, you know, with so many.
Yeah, exactly. Now, you write, I noticed immediately, because I am a big fan of good dialogue, because I think good dialogue creates the ambience of a book, and it also creates, it embellishes the characters, you know, so you really feel that you are right there listening to them talk. You write wonderful dialogue, and maybe you could talk a little bit about your feelings about how writers might approach writing dialogue, good dialogue.
Janet Burroway, I don't know if you know her, but she wrote a book called Writing Fiction. And she defines character as flesh-made word, which is about as precise a definition as I can imagine for what you're trying to do when you're creating the book and also when you are writing dialogue. Now, one of the ways in which I learned my dialogue was to go to playwrights. And I'm a big Shakespeare fan, and of course my stuff doesn't sound like Shakespeare, but when you read Shakespeare, one of the things that you realize is that he is using dialogue to create character. It isn't so much the plot of Shakespeare, it's the beauty of the words and his ability to use the dialogue, these people talking back and forth, that bring the characters alive. And so I'm not saying go to Shakespeare, although there's nothing, you know, be great for all writers to read Shakespeare, but I'm saying go to the playwrights and take a look at how they are able, through creating dialogue almost exclusively, to create character and to read what they have to say. As far as one character talking to another, or one character talking about another, or one character talking to himself or herself, how they're able to take human speech and create character out of that. Shakespeare again, Hamlet. Why is Hamlet so immortal? Again, it's not the plot of that play. It's the way he talks and talks and talks, right? Words, words, words. But what word? You know, you go to Tennessee Williams and you read such passionate, emotional dialogue there, and you can absorb that. And you go to Arthur Miller, you look at how down to earth and easy his dialogue is, and yet how it has deeper meanings, how it resonates with these deep meanings. You go to Edward Albee, you look at Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and you can see the force and the power and the emotion behind these two people bickering. And you can learn just by reading these playwrights how they handle that dialogue, and then you practice it on your own. You get, there's a sort of osmosis that goes with it. You're reading great writers at the same time. You can't get by in this business if you're not a reader. It just won't happen. So you go back to the really great novelists like Leo Tolstoy, or short story writers like Anton Chekhov. Or you go to modern-day writers like John Updike, Alice Munro. The list could go on for pages and pages. And you learn. I can't actually pick up anything without studying it anymore. It's not a matter of sitting back and just enjoying a story, I'm constantly aware of how they're doing it. And where is the authenticity in the dialogue that makes it makes the character so believable, so three-dimensional. So I'm constantly looking at that, aware of it. When I do my own dialogue, when I sit down to write dialogue, first of all, it's a matter of just creating in my mind that continuous dream that John Gardner talks about, wherein you got two, three, four characters, and they're talking. And so one says something and one says another, and that'll make somebody else say something else. And then eventually you've got maybe two, three pages in which you go back and you begin to polish and glean that. And the last thing you do that is really important, and I've done it with every one of my books, is you read it out loud. You listen with your ear as you're reading, because as you do that, you will catch the authentic and the inauthentic rhythms of your dialogue. And if you don't stumble on things, if things flow fairly smoothly, you realize that that part, that rhythmical part of honest dialogue is working for you. The rest of it is a lot of just what really do you have to say, and how are you going to make this character into somebody that, as you're saying there, you can actually see that seem to leap up on the page and talk to you like little bitty people or something. So it's a long, arduous process, but it's worth every second of it to work on that dialogue and not just leave it limp and cliché and stereotypical, and try to find ways in which, you know, somebody lisps, or somebody has a hum, or somebody whistles, or things that these little touches that the great writers like Tolstoy again have that bring these characters alive through speech.
Well, this is what we're talking about in general too, is we're talking about the craft of writing, and part of the I love good dialogue, and if I find the dialogue is not authentic to the character and the story, I find it very hard to get through a book like that. I need to be transported there, and one of the best ways is exactly what you're saying, is through good dialogue, and that's an art. That's a real art.
And it takes a lot of work, and as you know, it's a craft that you're never finished with. I tell my students, you know, you've got a lifelong apprenticeship here. You're maybe 20 years old. Well, when you're 60 years old, you will still be learning how to do this. It's not something that you just, you know, clicks in and then you do everything right. If that were true, you'd need one draft and off it would go and be a bestseller or whatever, you know. But that's not how this business works. You're constantly learning again and again how to do this better and better and better.
Yeah, and that's the great joy of it, is that if you really love this kind of work, then it's just an ongoing, it's work, but it's also very pleasurable to edit and hone it so that you're just very, very accurate with what you had in mind. There it is on the page, and you've really, like a sculpture, really carved that out.
Yeah.
Great joy in that.
There is a great joy in it. You know, you polish and you polish and you get this feeling. What was it? You know, Hemingway said, you know, I can write at least one true line. Well, there's this great feeling about writing one true line, and you've as you say, carved it, or however you want to explain it. You've put it down in such a way that it seems like you can't add one word to that without messing it up, and you can't take one word out without messing it up. And when you're at that point, then you know at that point at least leave that line alone, you know, move on to the next line. I tell my students about this too, that you, when you think you're done, that's when you actually need to go back and go through it again. Because you think you're done, and you're not done. Maybe you're never done in this business, I don't know. But you've got to go back, and you have got to weigh every word. And when I reject stories for perigee, the main reason I will reject stories is because the author has not weighed his or her words. That is, every word should carry weight. There should be a reason why that word is in the story. And you can tell whether or not it belongs or it should be tossed out. And until you get to that place where you know which words should actually be there, you're not finished as far as I'm concerned. So I think it's the really good authors that that continue to weigh their words and polish their language before they send it out. And even that doesn't guarantee that you're not going to be rejected. But as we talked before, if you can get it in front of the right pair of eyes, somebody's going to really appreciate it, and they're going to see what you've done. They're going to see how hard you've worked, you know.
I always like to ask authors what their work program is. In other words, when you're writing a book, you have a discipline put together to bring that book together, to get those ideas. What's your method there?
Yeah, for years and years, I have sat myself down where I'm sitting right now talking to you, and that's the first thing I do in the morning when my mind is freshest. So I make sure that unless something extraordinary happens, I don't have anything else to do in the morning. I get up, I have my coffee, have something to eat, and I sit down, and I go over what I wrote the day before, and that will get me moving through in the next part of the story, scene, or whatever it might be. And I'll try for at least 4 hours to get together something around 3-4 pages that I'm not too disappointed with, and that I know I can polish and work on some more. And then I'll try to spend times, especially in the evening or whenever I do have moments of my own, reading. I believe that, at least in my experience, what you do when you write is you kind of empty the well, and then you need to fill that well again. And that reading, a regimen of reading every day, will help you fill that well. Also, reading will give you ideas, because you don't always know, or at least I don't always know, what I'm going to do the next day. I know I've got a place to start from because I wrote something the day before, but I don't always know where this is going. So sometimes in reading, something will just kick up in my head, and I keep 3x5 cards around all the time. They're everywhere, if you could see my house, and in my pocket, and pens, and I quickly write that idea down. I found out that if I don't do this, I'll lose it. I will wake up at night with an idea, and I get myself up and write that idea down, because you know, if you lie there, and I've done this, you know, lazy times, I'll lie there and I'll say, oh, that's such a good idea. You'll remember it for sure in the morning, you know. And then I'll wake up in the morning and I'll say, what was that idea? I know I had a good idea, but I can't remember what it was. So I'm in the habit now always of writing things on 3x5 cards. And I've, you know, it's anything you can use, any kind of tablet, any kind of piece of paper,
right,
to get these ideas down. Then you sit down. You sit down there and you looked at what the note that you gave yourself, and you're off and running again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think those. I think that the area of craft is something that people, all beginning writers, really need to pay attention to, and the discipline of doing it every day, like you say, really helps you to bring yourself together. So that actually, in some ways, it becomes a little bit easier, because your whole mind and body are involved and saying, okay, here we go again, and we're going to start up the process.
That's exactly right. That's a good way to put it, because your mind, your body gets used to it, and it's prepared. It doesn't take long to get your whole system prepared to write in the morning if you do it constantly. And so it's kind of jarring, actually, not to. When I'm working on another novel right now, I don't take any days off unless something extraordinary happens. Like I say, I work 7 days a week. I work every morning, and my mind is always ready to do this. Yeats had an idea about this, and he said that what you do when you discipline the mind in that way is that you tap into the river of creativity that flows throughout the entire world. This idea that there is some kind of spiritual river that flows through all of us that artists are able to tap into because they've stayed with that and swam in it, so to speak, again and again and again, and you can tap into it, and once you do, it'll start telling you things that you did not know before. These are, you call them inspired moments or whatever it is. It's, you know, your subconscious or whatever is working on this flow of ideas that has permeated our entire planet, and so that you can go right anywhere in this world, and this flow of ideas you carry with you that has come down from our ancestors all the way to this particular point. But it does go back to this idea of discipline. And if you don't do it, it will abandon you. You know, the muse will abandon you. And then you're going to have to, you know, get down on your knees or whatever to get that muse to come back and talk to you again.
Well, you know, I think it was Hemingway that said that he used to always end up a day's writing on a high point, knowing where he was going.
Yes.
So that the next day he came back to work, it was easy for him to start because he knew where he was going. And that got him going, and then he went on from there. And I think that's a beautiful way of doing it.
That's a very good idea. Sometimes he would cut himself off in mid-sentence, and you know, knowing what the rest of the sentence is, just so that he could use that to leap forward the next day. Yes.
Yes.
Well, if you would like, and you have it handy there, I'd love you to read a little bit of your novel, just to give the readers an idea of the tone of it, and if do you have it there?
Sure, I do. Yeah, I'd be glad to. Okay. All right, this is just chapter one in the Book of Mamie, and the chapter is entitled Drownin' Man. Mamie Beaver, she had to come from the moon, or maybe even the stars. One star, big and fat and fiery, first one at night, starlight, star bright. It just seemed that way, seemed natural, more natural than she was John Beaver's daughter. Except that she had his size, she didn't look the thing like him. They were opposites. They were like two forces of nature, two winds coming from opposite directions, two mountains breeding landslides, two oceans battling it out, making storms like the Atlantic and Pacific dueling at Cape Horn. Mamie Beaver, head like a proud pumpkin, a froggish ear-to-ear smile, retarded Mamie Beaver, brain of a five-year-old, quiet and slow-moving body with arms held straight down, fingers rigid like Frankenstein's monster. She was a farmer's daughter, and she was his mule. Her strength was legend throughout northern Wisconsin. Her father would loan her out for harvest work, and it was said she earned him enough in season so that he didn't have to keep but a pig and a steer and a dozen milk cows together with his garden, and that was enough for the two of them to live at Bowles Knoll, independent of the world. We were farmers too, But there were nine of us all together with Mama and Pa and six boys and one girl, so we never had any cause to hire Mamie. She was just girl, the myth legend kind, like the Amazons or Wonder Woman. We'd heard stories about her all our lives, and Pa used those stories to put us in our place once in a while, especially if we whined about something he wanted us to do, like putting up bales, 1,000 bales in the field, each one weighing 50 to 60 pounds, and having to get them in because rain was expected overnight. Oh, he'd say, don't trouble your puny selves. Mamie'll be by soon and show you how it's done. None of us could stand the thought of a balloon-headed beaver coming to add notches to her reputation at our expense. The hay always got up without me.
Yes, it's just wonderful, Duff, and thanks very much for that. I think that really just gives a very slight flavor of the tone of the book and the style of the writing, and I just highly recommend it for anyone that's interested in modern-day literature and storytelling, because Duff Brenna is definitely a professional. And he also has six books in total, I should say, published. And maybe you'd just like to list those books again for us, Doc.
I've got, of course, the Book of Mamie. And then after I wrote the Book of Mamie, I wrote a book called The Holy Book of the Beard. And that's a book set in San Diego, where I visited and stayed a while when I was a teenager. And I wrote about sort of the downside of the underworld, I would say, of San Diego. And then I wrote a book called Too Cool. And Too Cool was also published by Doubleday. It got absolutely unbelievable reviews in the New York Times and other newspaper venues and magazines. And that's the story of a young man who runs away in a stolen car with his girlfriend and gets stranded in a snowstorm in the Rocky Mountains of Colorado, and what he has to do to survive. That book also has been optioned for film, and the screenplay has been written, and hopefully that'll be made into a film one of these days as well. And I wrote a book after that called The Altar of the Body. This one also got tremendous reviews. This one, I go back to Minnesota and I set it there, and it's the story of a man who is just sort of living his life calmly day after day, and one day his cousin shows up with his girlfriend, who is a Las Vegas showgirl, and her mother, who has Alzheimer's. And the cousin is a bodybuilder on the seedy side of it, of that profession, and going downhill. And the story revolves around these four characters and each of their points of view of what life is all about. And this one character, whose name is George, who's trying to hold it all together while these people are living with him and pretty much wrecking his life. After that, I wrote that book, and then I moved to Yukon, Canada, and I wrote a book called The Willow Man. And I base it on a story about a man named Albert Johnson, who lived in the Yukon and created havoc up there among the Mounties. He's one of the characters that they found very difficult to bring to bay, you might say. He killed one of them, and then there was this huge chase through the snowy January mountains of the Yukon. And so I loosely base this story on him, and I have the same kind of idea of someone trying to chase this man down. And again, it's a story of survival against great odds. And then The last book I've written has just come out not too long ago. It's called The Law of Falling Bodies. And again, I go back to Minnesota, which I'll never get out of my system. I hope one day to retire back there and just live there forever. And I go back to Minnesota and I pick up on some of the themes that I actually brought out in my first book, in Mamie. One of the things that comes out in Mamie is the farmer's survival on the farm. And so I went back to my own childhood on the farm and how it was to try to get through when economics were just against you. And so I create this character during the time of the Vietnam War. And this boy, whose grandfather has a stroke, has to be a man all of a sudden. And he has to make this dairy farm run. And if he doesn't, it's going to go under. And his older brother is not there to help because his older brother has been sent to Vietnam. And so you get the young man's story, his name is Virgil, trying to keep this farm alive, juxtaposed with the letters from his older brother, Vernon, in the Vietnam War. And what you see in this, I think it's fairly easy to see, this theme of war. It's not just overseas 10,000 miles away, but there's a little micro war going on the farm as this farm is trying to survive. So that one is the last one, and I'm, like I said, I'm working on another one right now, which I finished the first draft of, and it'll probably take me a couple more years before I can get this one out.
Well, once again, Duff, I'd like to thank you very much for spending time with us today on Authors Audio and talking about your book, Mamie, and some of your other books, and of course, your thoughts on writing and the craft of writing and so on. Now, you have a website, and it's really duffbrenna.com. The magazine we're talking about, Perigee, is perigee-art.com. That's perigee-art.com. And you can have a look, and there's some wonderful reviews in there, and archive files as well. So until next time, keep dreaming and happy reading. This is Jake B. Steele. Bye.